Thank you for inviting me for giving a talk at this first Hoan meeting. Can you hear me all right?
Absolutely.
Thanks also to all of you for being here, and my special thanks to Fabiana and Federico for preparing and hosting this event. My short reflections today on hidden connections and broken trajectories through the example of 20th century interrelations between German speaking and international sociocultural anthropology will come in three sections. Be prepared, please, for some 20 to 22 minutes of verbal presentation accompanied by merely one visual in the last section. I'll start first with a few thoughts on where we stand in assessing and rewriting the history of those strands in sociocultural anthropology that originally were presented primarily, if not exclusively, in other languages than English. Second, I'll proceed by highlighting three short examples from the German-speaking countries for those hidden connections and broken trajectories that my title has pre-announced as deserving special consideration. From these examples, third, I'll turn to my conclusions with their focus on some basic methodological points, which I think might be of wider interest in our ongoing work for anthropology's history. In an epistemological sense of primary research interests, my main message today is to combine an emphasis on theoretical and conceptual pluralism with an insistence on observing minimal standards of methodological quality. From our recent and upcoming work in the history of German-speaking anthropology before and during the 20th century's two world wars, I'm convinced that it is this combination of theoretical pluralism with methodological professionalism which has been crucial for further advancing the good developments achieved in elaborating anthropology's history or histories during the past few years. So my talk will intentionally move from one to the other, from theoretical pluralism as it is inspiring our reflections and debates on premises, research strategies, and visions of adequate interpretations and discussion of results, on to methodological professionalism, which clarifies the empirical foundations of our investigations, making them accessible for others inside our field and beyond, and thereby providing for transparency regarding our source materials. In that sense, let me also emphasize from the outset that a previous older tradition of interweaving merely elements of oral local history with an assessment of some major published works is no longer sufficient today. That was part of an earlier set of generations post 1945 and before, but today we've moved beyond that. In view of recent research records in our subfield, it has become very clear that historians of anthropology in other languages than English, but also in English, have fully embraced the relevance of all available published and unpublished archival sources and book and article sources, together with visual and other, for instance, material object records. So we're now right in the middle of our first section, since this emphasis on either accessing for the first time or reassessing solid source materials covering much more than just oral history plus published major works really is cross-cutting through the recent writing of anthropology's histories at the margins of or outside of English-speaking academia. Two major examples for these and other recent advances in elaborating the history of anthropology from languages other than English that I want to mention at least briefly here are the texts by Dorothy Zinn, accompanying the fabulous translated publication of major works in Italian by Ernesto De Martino, and the splendid biography of Polish anthropologist Maria Czaplicka by Grażyna Kubica-Heller. These two sets of publications feature very important Italian and Polish legacies in our global subfield. By their own insights, they not only underscore the points I've made so far on combining conceptual pluralism with methodological professionalism and sound source materials in an encompassing way. Moreover, these works also highlight, for my arguments today, that the history of anthropology in German is just one among several legacies in their European dimensions. I haven't even referred to other legacies yet with comparable advances, such as those, for instance, in Portuguese or in Spanish. Some of these legacies are largely confined to the boundaries of specific national states, but many are not. Others were transnational from the outset, such as the German or the Portuguese legacies. Some of these legacies, in fact, were cross-cutting the colonial and post-colonial divide, others less so. Let me also add, as an expert primarily for various regions of Asia, the necessity to retrieve and to reassess the anthropological records in substantial academic languages outside of Europe, such as Arabic, Malay, or Chinese. There can be no doubt that decolonizing the history of anthropology certainly has to remain an enhanced priority on our agenda in this global subfield while we retrieve the marginalized and the forgotten together with questioning established hegemonies. So the wider context and priorities have been clarified, within which I'll now turn to my second section. By addressing three examples for hidden connections and broken trajectories in German. Example one concerns Paul Kirchhoff, or Kirchhoff, as he's often mispronounced in English, who lived from 1900 to 1972. He was a German-born Mesoamericanist of some recognition among anthropologists, either with a US-American education, and of course, among most experts for the Mexican and Mesoamerican regions. In fact, Kirchhoff even coined the term Mesoamerica as his creation in the 1940s. In fact, inspired by the culture area and culture circle paradigms that he knew best. Kirchhoff had been a native of North Rhine-Westphalia and an activist for Trotskyist groups in Germany. In Berlin and Leipzig, he studied theology and psychology, but also ethnology with a previous associate of Friedrich Engels, turned museum director, that was Heinrich Kuhnel. In 1931, Kirchhoff emigrated to the US, but was expelled from there in 1936 for political reasons. Finally settling down in Mexico City, Kirchhoff also broke with Trotsky, whom he repeatedly had met there before his assassination. He acquired Mexican citizenship and continued an academic career at UNAM in the networks around Angel Palermo. Theoretically, he pursued the somewhat unusual combination of Marxism with secular diffusionism. And he's perhaps best known for his concept published in Spanish, English, and German of conical clan systems, a concept which integrates hierarchies of senior and junior genealogical status into pre and early state formations. In fact, he had already launched early versions of this concept in one of his first articles for the Zeitschrift für Ethnologie during the early 1930s. Kirchhoff's case actually has become known to some considerable extent in international anthropology, if only belatedly. David Carrasco belongs to the main biographers of Kirchhoff's career in its marginalized and broken sequences between Germany, the US, and Mexico, and between theology, Marxism, and anthropology. But quite a few sources in German still remain to be retrieved and reassessed. Example two refers to Marianne Schmiedl, the first female doctoral graduate from Völkerkunde or sociocultural anthropology at the University of Vienna. Coming from a liberal middle-class family of artistic orientations and with some fairly secularized Jewish converts background into Catholicism, she lived from 1890 to 1942 when she perished during deportation to a Nazi mass murder camp. Her 1916 doctoral thesis continues to be referenced to this day as a foundational work in mathematical anthropology, addressing the various ways of counting and calculating across cultures through archival and library studies in her case. Following her doctoral degree, her interests in systematic analysis through cross-cultural variations led her to pursue a long-term research project in sub-Saharan women's basket weaving techniques. This led her through most among the relevant museum collections in Central and Western Europe. In her time, she thus was fairly well known for these investigations, which also included articles of wider relevance, such as her Grundlagen der Nilotenkultur, Foundations of Nilotic Culture from 1935. Due to her professional position outside the main institutions of anthropology, and then also increasingly under pressure from persecution by the Nazis, she never was able to sufficiently complete her basket weaving project. The spin-off articles she did publish, however, demonstrate that this also was an early tribute to sub-Saharan Black female skills and knowledge. Beyond narrow circles of experts, Marianne Schmiedl's name was largely forgotten until her main biographer, Katja Geisenhainer, came out with a major monograph in German in 2005, and then helped us to establish a public memorial stone in her honor in Vienna. Outside the German-speaking world, Schmiedl's work certainly still would deserve some wider recognition. The same, namely deserving some wider recognition, is not exactly what needs to be said about my third example, Christoph Führer-Hammendorf. He lived from 1909 to 1995 and was a leading representative of functionalist anthropology, both in the German language and the British traditions between the mid-1930s to the late 1970s. A famous ethnographer in visual documentations and in written publications of various Himalayan and Indian local societies, a founding director and full professor at the London SOAS since 1950s, and a one-time president of the Royal Anthropological Institute during the 1970s. I personally knew Führer-Hammendorf, and together with many others in Britain and in South Asia, I have no doubt about his enormous skills and professional qualities as an ethnographer of minority groups in the South Asian subcontinent, the results of which have been skillfully documented by Alan McFarlane and others in the UK. In the case of the early sequences of his biography, however, I've had the somewhat unpleasant task to handle also his Vienna records between early 1933 and the late summer of 1939. During these years, he first became a more or less convinced sympathizer and member of legal as well as illegal Austrian Nazi organizations. And after Austria's occupation by Germany in the spring of 1938, Führer-Hammendorf then for some time hoped that Chamberlain's appeasement policies towards Hitler might work out. During more than a year, he therefore served the new regime of the Nazis, basically by continuing to follow his elder brother's advice, who was an ardent Nazi activist. While preparing his first international bestseller on the Naked Nagas, for simultaneous publication in English and in German in 1939, He was a member of Nazi organizations and also helped to implement the regime's purges of left-leaning and Jewish students from the University of Vienna Ethnology Institute. Only when appeasement politics collapsed with the Nazi invasion of the Czech lands did he and his English wife prepare to leave Vienna by taking virtually the last ship to India before the war broke out. He gave up the German passport imposed upon him in 1938, together with the Anschluss, became a British government anthropologist in India since 1940, and a British citizen thereafter, but reassumed Austrian citizenship in the 1950s. Feuerhammendorf never fully disclosed, but he definitely regretted his early and partial involvement about 6 years with some of the initial repressions launched under Hitler's regime. And it's no accident that he's buried not in London, but in a small community cemetery in Vienna's upper crust garden belt in a family grave. After all, his aristocratic family had been serving the House of Habsburg throughout 400 years until 1918. So at the end of these three examples and of our second section, we see three possible outcomes of our endeavors to explore hidden connections and broken trajectories. Enhancing existing insights in Kirchhoff's case by adding additional hitherto unknown sources and their future interpretations to the existing record, retrieving, upgrading and honoring an almost forgotten legacy in Marianne Schmiedl's case with the additional dimension of honoring African women's cultural and social legacies. And finally, providing a more nuanced and more differentiated insight into Feuerhammendorf's well-known biography. These and other examples may, of course, be researched through very different theoretical and research interests, as long as we do not enter the scene with any predefined dualities. Not everybody with, say, a hegemonic background in his or her time was by any necessity a lousy anthropologist. And not every marginalized researcher by definition was an ingenious anthropologist. The differentiated wide middle ground in their various shades between such dualistic streams remained to be very carefully considered. For such skillful and reliable consideration and investigation, sound methodologies are indispensable indeed. This brings me to my third and final section on methodological professionalism. So may I now ask Fabiana and our hosts to please make that graph slide become visible on our screens. Thank you very much. In our introduction to the three volumes on sociocultural anthropology in Vienna and in exile that will come out this summer in German, my co-editor Peter Rohrbacher and I address five main interrelated approaches in methodology that we found useful in this endeavor. Peter Rohrbacher will forgive me that I've now visualized that section of our joint introduction in my own responsibility for this graph that I've rebaptized as a methodological pentagram. Please imagine the white background as the flow of time and of contemporary history. Or if you prefer that, imagine contemporary history as a wider circle around the pentagram. What matters is that the pentagram is not static, but embedded within the flows of history. The pentagram's five corners are symbolically standing for main methodological approaches, each of them being based on direct and indirect source-based indicators. My presentation of three examples in the previous second section were all based on biographies marked here as the pentagram's corner number one. They all related these respective biographies to institutional affiliations marked here as number four and to genealogies of ideas such as diffusionism or functionalism here being represented as number five. distinguishing claims and justifications from actual practices not only was important in Fuhrer Hemmendorf's case, the strong emphasis on actual practices in Bourdieu's sense, if you want, is visualized as the pentagram's corner number two. Finally, networks were explicitly mentioned in Paul Kirchhoff's case, but they're also visible in existing publications for the two other examples, here being visualized as number three. This, of course, refers to qualitative networks or thinking with networks, as Ulf Hannertz has aptly phrased it, quantitative network analysis rarely being possible within these contexts usually addressed by historical anthropologists and by historians of anthropology for that matter. The important point is that during our research processes, each among these five corners is more or less interacting through our investigations with all the other four corners in the pentagram. Once we understand, for instance, that why and if Paul Kirchhoff had established himself in Mexico City in 1937, we need to explore what his early academic affiliations were, for instance, at UNAM, as I've mentioned, which ones became his relevant academic and political networks, for instance, around Angel Palerm, how these factors then had a return impact upon his biography and scholarly practice, and so on and so forth. I'm not claiming that the pentagram is exhaustive. All I want to suggest is that it might be helpful in observing minimal professional standards of methodology, which, to repeat myself, is indispensable for advancing our methodologies together with conceptual pluralism. In fact, promoting conceptual and theoretical pluralism together with some minimalist standards in methodological professionalism will help to integrate the elaboration of our discipline's history as part of sociocultural anthropology at large for gaining sufficient recognition there. Simultaneously, this will also promote our standing vis-a-vis colleagues from other disciplines, such as history and science studies, for enriching dialogues and exchanges. Featuring sound records and research processes in a discipline's past should become a self-understood dimension in any respectable academic field's overall portfolio, including, last but not least, appropriate jobs and recognized budgets for actually pursuing this task. Thanks very much for your attention. I'm now looking forward to your comments and questions.
Thank you very much.